From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Talks in Geneva, Switzerland, on Iran's nuclear program broke down last weekend. They'll start again next week. John Kerry and the Obama administration's push to engage Iran, find a deal short of war, military action, is not over. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is hopping mad. He doesn't trust Iran and doesn't think the U.S. should either. Congress is watching warily. Secretary of State Kerry saying today it's the job of the executive branch to craft foreign policy. This hour, On Point, nuclear negotiations with Iran and the U.S.-Israel split here. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this the time to pick up on more moderate signals from Iran and cut a nuclear deal or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been saying very loudly and clearly all over the place, this is not the way to go. This is not the right path to a deal. Here he was last Friday saying that a proposed deal on the table at that time on Iran's nuclear program and sanctions was very bad.
So Iran got the deal of the century, and the international community got a bad deal. This is a very bad deal. Israel utterly rejects it.
Of course, there's no deal yet. As those talks broke off, they're to resume November 20th. On Tuesday, at a press conference, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said the negotiations should help prevent war with Iran.
The American people, justifiably and understandably, prefer a peaceful solution that prevents Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And this agreement, if it's achieved, has the potential to do that. The American people do not want a march to war. And it is important to understand that if pursuing a resolution diplomatically is disallowed or ruled out, what options then do we and our allies have to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon?
We're looking at this debate, these two perspectives, and more today. Joining us first from Washington is Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. He's been following the talks and all the action around them. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Where do things stand today? First, on the negotiations with Iran, they've broken off. Have they broken off in a way that it looks promising? A resumption looks promising or not, Michael?
Yes. Well, I mean, a resumption is scheduled for November 20th in Geneva, as you said. The newest front is on Capitol Hill, where yesterday Secretary of State Kerry implored senators to hold off on additional sanctions because they might interfere with the talks. Obviously, the skepticism that you heard from Benjamin Netanyahu from the French has spread to Capitol Hill, particularly the Republicans, who fear that Obama and Kerry are about to sign a weak deal with Iran. But I think on the whole, to answer your question, it does look fairly promising. This was always about a temporary deal, basically a six-month freeze in Iranian uranium enrichment in exchange for a promise to ease some sanctions, which, as Kerry said yesterday, something that the U.S. could simply turn back on, that is the sanctions, if it so chose and if the Iranian government didn't comply.
So what are the basic perspectives here? I mean, I heard John Kerry just this morning say, look, it's basically negotiate or take military action. The suggestion there, war. Jay Carney saying explicitly that in the tape that we just heard here. If you don't want war, what's the option to negotiation? What's the White House perspective, the Secretary of State's perspective on this challenge right now versus Benjamin Netanyahu's?
You know, fundamentally, this is an issue of trust, I think, between the Israeli government and the U.S. government, and more specifically between Netanyahu and Obama. I mean, this goes back several years. You will recall in 2012, Obama gave a speech in which he said he's got Israel's back. That was also about this question of whether the Israelis could depend on the United States to ensure there would be no Iranian nuclear weapon. The threat of military force has been out there, and yet the Israelis Because, you know, I think have lost a little credibility on this because they've been talking about it now for the last few years. You'll recall that now famous speech that Netanyahu gave before the UN General Assembly in 2012 when he held up a simplistic diagram of an Iranian bomb and said Israel would have to act. Well, Israel hasn't acted yet. And now the fear, I think, among the Israeli security apparatus is that these negotiations will simply play out for a long, long time. The Iranians will not comply or will be secretly, you know, still working toward their nuclear weapons program, and military options will begin to peter out as they begin to bring facilities like the Fordo facility, which is deep underground and is, you know, not quite impregnable, but is fairly resistant to military assault, that those will become fully operational. So it's really a game of timing and a lot of political posturing right now.
John Kerry, Secretary of State, saying this morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe, said, "What's important here is we stand with Israel firmly. There's no distance between us about the danger of Iran's nuclear program, and the end game for us is exactly the same." He wanted to strongly emphasize that, you know, we're right there with Israel, but what he's saying is we both see the danger, the end game is the same, but the path that they seem to be looking for now out of the White House seems distinctly different from Netanyahu's. Now, why is that?
Well, look, in some respects, Benjamin Netanyahu is a very hardline prime minister from the Likud party, you know, has never seen a deal or an agreement that he really liked. And that's true both with the Palestinians and the Iranians. Essentially, what Netanyahu seems to be calling for is total surrender by the Iranians, shut down and eliminate your nuclear program, and then and only then, you know, will we lift sanctions. I mean, Kerry, as a savvy diplomat, knows that's impossible. I mean, you do have a much more cooperative regime, one that's hurting badly under the U.S.-imposed sanctions. And that has come out. Hassan Rouhani, the new Iranian president, and Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, and with the permission of the supreme leader, who is the ultimate hardliner in Iran, has, you know, come out and said we're willing to talk here and to, you know, freeze our uranium enrichment. I mean, the fact is Kerry knows and Obama knows that's really the most you're going to get right now. Netanyahu, as I said before, I think is mainly posturing. But what his, you know, what his alternative, if you will, adds up to is really just surrender. And that's not something that's feasible.
Iranian surrender, you're saying.
Exactly. Exactly.
Take us to Iran's nuclear program. What the United States appears willing to accept in terms of what would remain of that program, and in particularly in terms of enrichment versus what Israel's saying.
Yeah. Well, look, the deal that almost was, which was last Friday in Geneva, broke down largely over the French coming in and taking a harder line than the U.S. and insisting that the Iraq heavy water reactor, which can produce plutonium, be made part of the freeze, that the Iranians pledge, and verifiably so, to cease all construction. That sent the Iranians back, you know, to consult among themselves, and they decided they couldn't sign off on that, and so Kerry came out and then blamed the breakdown of talks on Iran. So I think what we're going to see now beginning, you know, November 20th, and I think there are already, you know, talks going on in back channels, is what can be given to the Iranians so that the Iranian moderates now negotiating can go back to their hardliners in Tehran and say, look, you know, this is a good deal for us. I mean, you have to remember that's part of it. These guys, that is Hassan Rouhani and Zarif, have to have some credibility because what their game is to win some kind of relief from sanctions that have really, really hurt their economy. That's the whole reason they're at their table in the first place. So I think we're going to see something like the old deal, you know, 6-month freeze in enrichment, perhaps with some guarantees of inspections by UN UN teams going into Iraq and some of these other facilities. And we'll have to see whether, in the end, if there is a deal, Obama and Kerry can persuade Netanyahu and hardliners in Congress and others that this is workable.
France reportedly balked, saying they were afraid that the oversight, the assurances weren't firm enough, that this would cut off a nuclear weapons program. What about their objections?
Well, again, there's a lot of political posturing here. I know I keep saying it, but it is part of the game. I think the French president was upset. He's very unpopular. He was upset when Obama pledged military action against Syria. And then the French backed that, and suddenly Obama moved away from that position and made a deal with Syria. I think that was very embarrassing to François Hollande, the French president. I think that the French wanted to convey the message to the Saudis and the Israelis and others that they're trying to curry influence with in the region, that that they're the hard guys and they're the hardliners, and that helps them. So there was some political posturing, but I think there was also French concerns of substance about the Iraq heavy reacted. But Obama and French President Hollande did speak on Wednesday by telephone, and Obama came out afterwards. U.S. officials came out afterwards and said they were presenting a united front now again against the Iranians. So there is a sense that that they're back, as part of the same team.
Michael, do you see a good cop, bad cop routine here, U.S. and Israel, or a real gap, a real split?
No, I do think that there is a real split. As I said, it has a lot to do with this mistrust between Obama and Netanyahu. The two men, have never really liked or trusted each other. We've seen numerous blow-ups. There's even a sense that Netanyahu may be tying the talks with the Palestinians, which have been faltering and which Kerry has also been pushing for, to getting his way on the Iranian issue. One of the things that happened this week was that the Israeli housing ministry came out and announced an additional 20,000 units in the West Bank, which, of course, is exactly the kind of thing that has gotten the Obama administration upset in the past, with the Israelis pledged to do something like this and the Palestinians walk away from the table. So, there's a sense that Netanyahu is playing a very sophisticated game here, saying, well, okay, if I don't have much leverage on this Iranian issue and I don't trust you on that, I'm going to hold the Palestinian talks hostage to that. So, we'll have to see how this plays out.
Hey, Michael, I've got one more question. Our time is so short. I apologize. You report, you also opine. You wrote a piece saying the U.S. should go for a grand bargain with Iran. In a nutshell, why?
Because so many pieces of the puzzle in the Middle East are about Iranian positions, Iranian support of Hezbollah in Syria, for example, Iranian support of Hamas, against Israel. If you don't come to some kind of agreement with Iran on this and other issues, you're likely going to have Iranian interference for years to come, across the board.
Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent at National Journal, joining us from Washington. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S.-Israel apparent split and more over negotiations with nuclear Iran and what happens now. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been very outspoken in Israel and just this last Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation, saying Iran cannot be trusted with the proposed deal.
This is a country that is fomenting terror in five continents. This is a country that pledges to destroy the state of Israel and subvert so many of the other countries. It's not only my concern that this is a bad deal. There are many, many Arab leaders in the region who are saying this is a very bad deal for the region and for the world. And when you have the Arabs and Israelis speaking in one voice, doesn't happen very often. I think it's worth paying attention to us.
We've paid attention to the U.S.-Saudi split on this. Today, looking at Israel, the Netanyahu argument and more. Secretary of State John Kerry also on Sunday, NBC's Meet the Press, saying, look, we are paying attention here.
We are not blind, and I don't think we're stupid. I think we have a pretty strong sense of how to measure whether or not we are acting in the interest of our country and of the globe, and particularly of our allies like Israel.
United States Secretary of State John Kerry. So here we are. With us today to look at this, Suzanne Maloney, Senior Fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. Suzanne Maloney, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Dubowitz, Executive Director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, heads its Iran Sanctions and Non-Proliferation Project, was testifying this week on Capitol Hill. Mark Dubowitz, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Suzanne.
Okay, so everybody's got their positions here. Suzanne, first to you. Do you see a real split in U.S.-Israel policy? What's driving it? Who's right if there are two opposing views here?
Well, clearly there are enormous tensions at the moment between Washington and Jerusalem over the issue of how to proceed with Iran. I think it has come something as a surprise to the administration because, in fact, the administration and all of its predecessors coordinate incredibly closely with Israel on policy toward Tehran. It's not clear to me that it's the substance of the deal that's really driving this split. I think that there is a deeper fear which is animating the concerns that we're hearing expressed by Israel. And that is that this kind of two-stage process, an interim deal at the outset, which would provide relatively modest rewards to the Iranians in return for, I think, what is a bigger package of concessions from their end than we'd ever anticipated before. Their concern is that we'll never make it to the final stage when the real constraints on Iran's nuclear program would come, and that over the course of the negotiations, there would be an erosion of international support for sanctions, and as a result, Iran's nuclear program would be legitimized, and effectively their effort to forestall this program would be lost as a result. I think those fears are overblown, and I think that ultimately we have to get to the source of them. But unfortunately, it's expressing itself in a way that is having real-time, immediate consequences very negatively for what I think is a very positive deal for the international community.
Mark Dubowitz, how do you see the potential deal and the different perspectives of Washington and Jerusalem on a deal?
Well, Tom, I think that there is a lot of support out there for a diplomatic solution, including from the Israelis. But I think what we're seeing is a wall of opposition to this interim deal, and not just from Israel, but from France, from Saudi Arabia, from the UAE, in fact, from many of America's moderate Arab allies. I mean, it is worth recalling that it was the French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, who came to Geneva and said, "This is a fool's game." The French see themselves as the guardians of nonproliferation, and they objected strenuously to an interim deal that they believed did not do anything to irreversibly roll back or freeze enough of the critical elements of Iran's military nuclear infrastructure.
Yeah, no, we get that. We heard that, and we have paid attention to it and will again. But today we're kind of looking at this core alliance where this is some pretty loud groaning in some different directions here. And I wish you could go to that, the two perspectives. What is it that the White House sees here? How is it different from what Benjamin Netanyahu may see?
Well, I think that the Israelis are deeply concerned. They believe that the Americans are at the high water mark of negotiating leverage because of the sanctions. And their concern is that if this is the high water mark of their negotiating leverage, and all they were able to do was conclude an interim deal that the French foreign minister called a fool's game, they believe over the next 6 months, the Iranians are going to enhance their negotiating leverage through nuclear physics. The Americans are going to diminish their negotiating leverage as the efficacy of sanctions diminishes. And that if you don't like the deal, the interim deal in Geneva, you're going to hate the final deal in 6 months' time.
Suzanne, where does the White House, the State Department's urgency come from here? Do they have a sense of a moment to be grasped with Iran? Is it a real fear? I mean, we heard Jay Carney, we heard John Kerry this morning, both kind of suggesting, look, it's negotiation or maybe war.
Well, I think it's hard for the critics of this deal to propose a viable alternative that results in a diplomatic resolution. I hear advocacy of maximalist terms that, in fact, we shouldn't give the Iranians anything until effectively their entire nuclear program has been dismantled. Ultimately, that's a strategy that the Bush administration tried and frankly, the Obama administration has sought to impose as well. I think if we can get something that stops the advance of the program, that in fact ties them to constraints not just on one aspect of the program, but really across the board, and which defers the real rewards of in terms of sanctions relief and a return to business as usual with some of the world to the conclusion of a final deal, there really isn't a rational opposition to such a deal. And in fact, I think it just gets at the sense of shock at how quickly things have moved. There are plenty of reasons why the French objections are really procedural, not substantive, and I think have largely been resolved. That obviously played into the media debate on all of this, and I think has created a sense that this deal is something quite paltry from the perspective of U.S. interests, when in fact quite the opposite is true. No one had ever anticipated that we would be able to persuade the Iranians to sign on to so much in exchange for so little. And this is really very much the deal of the century for the international community.
Is there a split in U.S. and Israeli interests here? We've talked on the show about Saudi Arabia, how it sees potentially its interests diverging from the United States' interests. Tom Friedman writing The Times this week saying, hey, pay attention to American interests here. They may not be the same as others, including Israel. Is there a split there now, Suzanne?
Well, I think ultimately we have a different view of the problem because of the relative degree of distance that we face. But I don't think that there's any lack of appreciation and sympathy for the interests of our closest ally in the region and one of our closest allies in the world, Israel. I think simply the recognition is that we have an opportunity to do something that for the first time in a decade would actually stop the expansion of the Iranian nuclear program in exchange for, you know, really what the Iranians have described in the past as peanuts. So, you know, to stop the advance of a program that has grown by leaps and bounds over the course of the past decade, even as we have been imposing sanctions, to avoid that chance, to miss that opportunity, I think would be a disservice not just to American interests, but also to Israeli interests.
Of course, you've got voices on Capitol Hill now saying, let's go the other way. Let's crank up the sanctions. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday saying, let's go that way.
I do think that we ought to be actually ratcheting up the sanctions against Iran. It's pretty obvious that what the administration was promoting is something the Israelis think is a bad deal for them. Pretty clear the Sunni Arab allies of ours also think it's a bad deal. Looking at it strictly from an American point of view, I think it's a bad deal as well.
Mark Dibowitz, there's some sense of where the urgency comes from on the American side. On the Israeli side, describe the roots of the urgency. Is it still Benjamin Netanyahu's, you know, fizzing bomb that he put before the UN? Is that the bottom line concern?
Well, the bottom line concern for the Israelis, and I think for the Americans as well, is that Iran has continued its advance to nuclear weapons capacity, that the Iranians have continued to install centrifuges, enrich uranium, and move their nuclear program down both a uranium pathway and a plutonium pathway. And in fact, the French objection to the deal in Geneva had more to do with substance than procedure. It had everything to do with the fact that they didn't believe the deal sufficiently constrained the pathway to a plutonium bomb. But listen, Tom, there's a fundamental misunderstanding, I would say, between the Israelis and the Americans on the issue of sanctions. And on Congressional Hill, I testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday, and there was a wall of Democratic support for escalating sanctions. So this is not a partisan issue. This is a bipartisan concern on Capitol Hill. And the fundamental difference is in perception. The business with Iran is driven by greed and fear. And in an environment of escalating sanctions, when the U.S. surrounds Iran with an economic minefield, fear overrides greed. When sanctions are being de-escalated...
You mean Iranian fear, you're saying there. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean fear of the business community. The businesses that want to do transactions with Iran in its energy sector and its lucrative commercial sector. And that businesses who want to do business with Iran are driven by greed and fear. And when sanctions are escalating, the U.S. surrounds Iran with an economic minefield. Fear overrides greed. When sanctions are being de-escalated, as they are today at the request of the administration, which is blocking congressional sanctions, greed will override fear. And the Israeli concern, and it's shared by Democrats and Republicans on the Hill, is that as you move through this interim stage over a six-month period, what will happen is that greed will begin to override fear, and businesses will go back to Iran, and the Iranians will be getting billions of dollars in hard currency that they need in order to stabilize their economy. And Ali Khamenei will one day not only have nuclear weapons capability, he'll have a stabilized economy with oil flowing where he can be a regional hegemon. He doesn't want to be the Persian equivalent of North Korea, of the Hermit Kingdom. He wants a bomb, he wants sanctions relief, and he wants regional influence. That's the concern.
Yeah, Suzanne Maloney, talk about interest then. I mean, Mark points at greed. He says business interests here. Carney, Kerry both talked about war as the interest is in avoiding war. There's yet another view which says, let's get the United States back on a positive path with Iran. You know, we should have a good relationship, not a bad one, after all these decades. What about business interests? What about the avoidance of war? What about this bigger vision, the relative weight of those, Suzanne?
I think it's an absurd assertion to suggest that companies are going to begin streaming back into Iran at a time when the sanctions that prevent any normal kind of business transactions will remain in place. And the legal liability, not just on institutions, but on individuals, is enormous. Many banks have paid significant fines, and Mark, among many others, is well aware of all of this. So there's really very little likelihood that a six-month waiver of some selective sanctions, relatively minor with respect to Iran's fundamental banking and oil economy, would have any impact on driving business back to Iran. It's simply a false assertion. But I think more importantly, you know, what we have is a chance to begin to wrap our arms around a problem that has plagued the international community for 11 years now. This concern about Iran's path toward a nuclear weapons capability that no administration, no set of sanctions has been able to forestall until now. This is the first real chance that we have to get a deal that would stop exactly the sorts of activities that Mark just suggested, the installation of centrifuges, the continuing enrichment at higher levels, and the path toward a multiple routes to a bomb. I think all of this would be frozen as a result of the interim deal, and ultimately the final deal upon which all sanctions, the really meaningful sanctions, would be contingent, would require the Iranians to do an enormous amount of reduction of their nuclear capabilities. And that would create, I think, real confidence about the prospects for avoiding war.
Sounds good if you can get it, if you trust it, I guess. Suzanne Maloney, Mark Dubowitz, let's go to our listeners. Will in Nashville, Tennessee. Will, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I am so glad you played that Mitch McConnell tape. I can't really do a good Mitch McConnell voice.
As you're close.
You clearly can't. But you know, it's so good to hear, you know, Capitol Hill talking about ratcheting up the sanctions. I don't think, you know, having just gone past Veterans Day, I don't think America can do a, you know, another war right now, especially in a region where we have not done so hot with the previous two.
So what should we do with Iran? Should we negotiate, or should we say, if you build, we'll fight?
Well, that's a good one. I think sanctions, ratchet them up, cut a deal, knowing that it probably won't be followed, you know, line by line by the Iranians, but cut a deal, start pulling back away from spreading so far out militarily and economically. I remember I'm in my early 30s, and I remember a game, a video game on the Sega in the early 90s called World War III. And you could take military options against other countries, but the most effective way was to wage an economic war. And it was way less violent, way less detrimental to that.
Well, we've got to, I appreciate your call. Suzanne, is ratcheting up sanctions the way to pull away from war in this case, or not?
Well, I'm going to take a sort of middle ground on this one. I don't favor moving forward with the sanctions bill that sits in the Senate Banking Committee at the moment, because I think what we have at this time is a unique opportunity to get a very good deal, and doing anything that compromises that seems foolish at
Kerry
this point.
Kerry has said if you go with sanctions, you could blow it all up.
Well, I think if you lose the negotiations, you really have few other alternatives. There's no good path to regime change, which I think many of the advocates of more and more sanctions really view as their ultimate goal. And ultimately, if you don't have a diplomatic pathway, you don't have a regime change pathway, you're left with one which is military force. And clearly no one in this country is eager to go that path again.
Mark Dubowitz, will more sanctions bring us closer to a better deal with Iran now? Is this the time to ratchet up?
I agree with the listener. I mean, you escalate sanctions not for regime change purposes. You escalate sanctions because it enhances your negotiating leverage. The President of the United States has made it very clear since 2008 that his declared policy is all options are on the table. He has taken the military option off the table. Nobody in Tehran or Jerusalem or anywhere else believes that this president is going to use military force to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities. He's preempted the Israeli military option, and now he's taking economic coercion off the table. Well, if you take
Excuse
the military
me,
option
Mark,
off
I'm
the
sorry,
table,
I have to
Suzanne,
interrupt
let me,
here.
Let me finish
when
if
exactly
you don't mind.
When exactly did the president take military action off the table? When did he preempt Israeli action?
We're going to come right back and look at both those. I'll give you both your chance there. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about nuclear negotiations with Iran and different perspectives around the world today, looking at the White House and Jerusalem and different perspectives right there. Senator, Secretary of State John Kerry saying, let's go for this. Let's try and make this work. Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel saying, this is a very bad deal and dangerous. Here's John Kerry saying, no more sanctions right now, please. It could destroy the ability to get to an agreement. Here's the Secretary of State.
And our hope is now that no new sanctions would be put in place for the simple reason that if they are, it could be viewed as bad faith by our count, by the people we're negotiating with. It could destroy the ability to be able to get agreement, and it could actually wind up setting us back in a dialogue that's taken 30 years to be able to achieve.
It's taken 30 years. Don't ratchet up sanctions right now. Iran talking a more moderate line lately. On Saturday, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif telling the BBC's Jeremy Bowen he believed the deal was still within reach.
The real hard work started during this meeting. We were all optimistic. We still are, probably more cautious now than we were a couple of days ago. But I think whether during this meeting or next meeting, these are all areas that can be resolved.
Of course, you've got different perspectives within every country. This was just earlier this month, anniversary of the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. Protesters gathered in Iran in front of the former U.S. embassy with this "Death to America" chant. We have factions all over here. Suzanne Maloney is with us from the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. Mark Dubowitz is here from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Let's go to our listeners. Shalom in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shalom, you're on the air.
Hi. My question and connected comment is, why are major facts relevant being ignored? I understand you present very dramatic confrontation supposedly between President Obama and Netanyahu, but this is not where it's at. The major facts, which I would like to very briefly enumerate, moderate supposedly president of Iran, two presidents back, Ali Akbar Rafsanjani, said he is willing to sacrifice 20 million Iranians just for destruction of Israel, which can be done with one bomb. Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president, said there would be devastating response if that happens, and therefore, I assume that Iran is not being stupid. They will attack America at the same time as they attack Israel.
Shalom, there are a lot of facts. We can't get to every fact in an hour, but do you think there's a reason to negotiate here or not?
Only if Iranians, if they really mean what they are saying and they don't intend to have nuclear weapons, open their country without any conditions, including plutonium and heavy water and everything, because what do they have to hide? If they don't want to do it, means they want to hide something. And the danger of Secretary Kerry is that he may be another, I have highest respect another Neville Chamberlain.
That's highest respect, but you think he's another Neville Chamberlain. I don't know how high that respect is, but I take the perspective. Suzanne, why go for an interim agreement? Why not go? I mean, the president's saying, look, we're not going to settle for anything that doesn't have full verification and, you know, ironclad assurances in it. So why not ask for that now? What's the significance of this interim agreement where it's not all nailed down?
Well, I think there is something of a debate that's emerging on this very question, in part because of the objections that have been raised. But there is valid and I think pretty sound rationale for going about it this way. The rationale is it's going to take time. It's going to take months. And would you like the Iranian nuclear program to expand while you're having those talks? Would you like them to have the ability to undertake provocative actions that would change the nature of their program and potentially ratchet the threat up dramatically while you're trying to talk about how to constrain it? I think it's much better to strike a deal that freezes things, that keeps them from advancing, and that enables you to push, because the major sanctions, the stuff that's really preventing them from, you know, making any money, making any foreign exchange from their oil exports, which have been dramatically reduced, those sanctions remain in place while you continue to negotiate for the final deal.
Mark DeVos, what about that argument? We've had 3 decades, if you're the United States, and more, of such cold relations with Iran. If we can start to warm it up, start to negotiate, get closer to a good deal, you know, and not have them going a full blast on any on a nuclear weapons program in the interim, what's the problem?
The problem is, Tom, the program is not being frozen. That's the problem. It's not being frozen. It's not being rolled back. There are certain elements of it. They're the less critical elements of the program. They're still continuing to enrich uranium at 3.5%. They'll have another bomb's worth at the end of the six-month period. They are still continuing to manufacture centrifuges. We're not getting a declaration on where they actually are manufacturing centrifuges. They could have thousands of new centrifuges at the end of 6 months. They could take some of those centrifuges, put them in secret enrichment facilities that we don't know about. On the sanctions side, unfortunately, it's that is not the conception. You can have a legal architecture. You can have sanctions on paper. But if we believe this administration is going to sanction companies from Beijing to Berlin, from Moscow to Paris over the next 6 months period in order to maintain the efficacy of sanctions, I think we're being deluded. I think the reality is over the next 6 months, the sanctions regime, while the architecture will remain, the pragmatic reality of these sanctions will diminish because they rely on enforcement. And the administration will not enforce sanctions against its P5 plus one allies. I think the caller was exactly right. Before we negotiate with Iran, they should be complying with 5 UN Security Council resolutions that call for the immediate suspension of all enrichment and reprocessing. They should also come clean on their past nuclear weapons activities. The IAEA has multiple questions that need to be answered. The fact is we are negotiating with pragmatists. But pragmatism doesn't make Iranian leaders less committed to an atomic weapon, less anti-American, more adverse to viewing terrorism as statecraft. The fact is Rouhani has a record that he brags about of nuclear deception. And we know, the Americans know, the Israelis know, he's lying when he says the Islamic Republic has never had any intention of building a nuclear weapon. This is about negotiating leverage. This is not a false choice between war and surrender. This is about negotiating leverage. The Iranians are enhancing their negotiating leverage through nuclear physics. We need to enhance our negotiating leverage through economic coercion.
Yeah, Jay Carney says, you know, it's about a potential march to war. You say the White House is reading that wrong? I mean, when American presidents say, and they more than one now said everything's on the table, I think Americans understand that that's a pretty wide spectrum. In the past, that has certainly included war when we start to talk like that.
The fact of the matter is the President of the United States himself has made it very clear that all options are on the table. He has said that if the Iranians don't comply, he will stop the Iranians from developing nuclear weapons through military force. The fact of the matter is,
so it's not a false choice.
We all want a better deal. The fact of the matter is, in order to get a better deal, according to the administration's own declared policy, you need coercive diplomacy. According to their own declared policy, coercion is the credible threat of military force, which has been severely undermined, and it's economic sanctions, which they're de-escalating at a time where they should be escalating, while the Iranians are advancing their nuclear program in certain critical areas by enhancing their negotiating leverage. I mean, Suzanne's husband, Ray Takei, has written brilliant pieces on exactly this, about when you look at the Iranians and you analyze how they negotiate, they have been misleading the international community for years.
Suzanne,
and they're using nuclear physics to enhance that leverage.
Mark, stand by. I want to get to our callers. We've got Bob in Grafton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Bob.
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is a critical question for America, and I'm delighted to see it debated here. I've been listening to the speeches from Iran, and I'm glad to hear that there's some possible daylight in what looks to me a very dangerous and dark situation. On the other hand, I have to tell you, I'm alarmed that this is being met, that their speeches and pronouncements are being met by threats of new and harsher sanctions. So starting from the point where we really don't want a war, and I'm personally not a practiced diplomat, here's my question. In the context of international diplomacy, is there realistically anything more that we could expect Iran to say or do?
Good, simple question. Thank you for it, Bob. Let me bring it to you, Suzanne. When we get back into negotiation next week, Iran's gone back now, Kerry's come home, everybody's talked to everybody, you know, away from the table. When they come back, is there something more that the U.S. and the rest of the P5 could press for that might give more assurance to members of Congress, even to Israel for that matter, and that Iran could reasonably offer now? If there is, what?
I think at this point, you know, the Secretary Kerry and his counterparts from the P5+1, including the French, have come to a draft that they're very comfortable with. It incorporated the relatively minor substantive changes that the French were looking for. And there is a considerable degree of optimism that the Iranians can live with that. I think, you know, we have, as I said, a deal that, you know, 6 months ago no one anticipated. We went to the table earlier this year offering many of the same incentives to the Iranians and asking them to do much less in return, and they walked away from that. So I think we have got more in it from the Iranians in exchange for giving them relatively little. And that sets us up very well, I think, for a longer-term deal. And in that case, you know, I don't think that capitulation is a likely outcome. And I think that while you press for the perfect deal that results in rollback, then you will continue to see centrifuges spinning. Mark, I think, has mischaracterized what is in the interim deal. It would not be a freeze of all enrichment, but it would prevent the Iranians from installing new centrifuges. It would prevent them from operating their higher level, more advanced centrifuges. It would include constraints and numerous verification and inspection improvements. And of course, all of this is just while we negotiate. The final deal would require the Iranians to do quite a bit more if they're ever going to see a return to business as usual.
Mark, from your perspective, we're back at the table next week. Is there something else that could be asked for that Iran could reasonably give, given its own politics at home and everything else at this point, that might bring a negotiated agreement within a satisfactory purview from your perspective?
Well, Tom, as I mentioned, I think that one of the things the Iranians could do very easily is they could admit to decades of military nuclear activity, to decades of military nuclear deception that the IAEA has substantiated and that the IAEA wants specific answers to. So if they are not willing to admit to lying to the international community over the past few decades on their military nuclear program, how can we take any promises, any commitments of Iranian transparency going forward? And now some might say, well, we can't, which is why we have a verification and inspection regime that we're going to put in place in a post-deal environment. The problem is, what happens when the Iranians start cheating on verification and inspection? And they don't cheat egregiously. They cheat incrementally. Are we to believe that the President of the United States will use military force to force the Iranians to stop cheating, to allow them to admit inspectors into their facilities? We don't believe that is credible. We don't think that's the way that this enforcement mechanism will work. And then the problem is, what do you do? How do you get the Iranians to stop cheating once you've signed a deal with them?
Mark, hold that thought. Suzanne, would conceding a military agenda that it's been woven through this program be tantamount to capitulation, your word?
No, I think, but Mark's moving the goalposts effectively. The Iranians signed a deal earlier this week with the International Atomic Energy Agency to work through at least some of the areas of concern that the agency has with regard to its past behavior. It certainly isn't a wholesale admission of anything, and there are a number of other areas where the agency has not substantiated but has in fact raised the possibility of military dimensions to the program that they would like answers on. And obviously, you want to see that process continue.
But Suzanne, ultimately, why not ask the Iranians to come clean on their past military nuclear deception? It's very easy for the Iranians to do that.
I think we are. I don't think the international community has withheld that request. I think the question is, do you want to freeze a program at this time, or do you want them to keep expanding? And it seems to me that the advocates of sanctions today, those who oppose an interim deal, really are not going to be satisfied with any kind of a deal and aren't going to be satisfied with any kind of diplomacy with Iran. And, you know, the fact that the Iranians until now have been unwilling or unable to come to the table in a serious way was awfully convenient. Now that they are, now that they're prepared to deal, there seems to be a wholesale aversion to having any kind of diplomatic negotiations with them at all.
The fact of the matter, Suzanne, the reality, as you know, is that what they're asking for, what the U.S. Congress is asking for, what the French and others are asking for and have been asking for, is consistent with 5 UN Security Council resolutions that call on Iran to immediately suspend all enrichment and reprocessing.
Mark, we know that history. I've got
that's
2 minutes.
No, but yep. It's an important point. It's
no,
important
it is,
point.
And it's made, and
it's
we've got it.
Important point.
Here, Suzanne, I want to cut to this point. Americans are listening to this and trying to figure this out. I think they want to be good allies to Israel, not throw it under the bus, but many don't want to go to war. Mark says that's a false choice between some kind of deal and war. Is that a false choice? I mean, Jay Carney says Americans don't want to march to war, suggesting that that might be the alternative to a negotiated deal.
I think if we play the spoiler at this stage, if Congress makes it impossible for negotiations to move forward, we really have very few other options for stopping Iran's progress toward a nuclear weapons capability.
Options other than what?
Our options are really negotiations or some sort of military action further down the line. And I think
is there military action that does not mean war, or is that the same when John Kerry says military?
Yes, one and the same. One and the same. There's no way to stop the Iranian nuclear program without what would be a long, unpredictable, and very costly war.
But Tom, there
Mark,
is.
How about it's a deal called, or war? Well, are those the options?
Tom, the option is a better deal through coercive diplomacy consistent with the president's strategy of having credible military thrust and economic sanctions. This is not about war or no deal. This is about a better deal that stops Iran's march to nuclear weapons capability. And getting a better deal depends on enhanced negotiating leverage. It means we've got to enhance our economic leverage.
Yeah,
we've got to make sure
Suzanne
we can constrain
theirs. Suzanne
says
you want surrender. You want capitulation.
But
surrender.
But that's a complete mischaracterization. Surrender to 5 UN Security Council resolutions is not capitulation. It's what the international community has demanded for years.
Well, I mean, you get into UN Security Council and lots of countries are not necessarily in line with those, Israel included, but so here we
They're
are.
All united, Tom. It was passed unanimously.
Yeah,
they're all united,
yeah,
Tom.
Yeah, fair enough. Complicated scene. Negotiations start up again next week. We will be watching more informed with the background of this conversation in our minds. Mark Dubowitz at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Suzanne Maloney at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute, thank you for joining us today, Suzanne.
Thank you.
In this hour tomorrow, we'll look at the week of the news, and there has been a lot from the typhoon to Obamacare numbers, new guidelines for statins, and a lot more. Join us for our weekly news roundtable. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.